Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 5th. Wow, it's already November 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And I apologize that I am posting this pretty late in the day. For some of you on the East Coast or in other countries, it may already be Tuesday. And I apologize for the state of my voice. It's because I just finished up with SciComm Camp 2018. It's our fourth annual this year. And oh my gosh, it was the best one yet. We just had so much fun. If you were there at SciComm Camp, I want to thank you for coming and making it such an amazing experience. If you didn't have a chance to come and you're interested in science communication, I really do urge you to check it out because it's just like, it's hard to explain how great the community is, how great the opportunities are there. It's kind of not anything like it seems. I don't know. It's one of these things where you just have to go to understand what I mean, but it's a great science communication retreat, training opportunity, networking opportunity. Those all sound like gross buzzwords. It's just so much more than that. Okay, enough about that spiel. Oh, also some kind of cool stuff happened just before that. I was on Jeopardy earlier last week reading clues for the new National Geographic Almanac 2019. That was super cool. I've posted it on my social channels and I'll try to share it again so that you can find it, but you can probably look it up online as well. Kind of a career highlight there. And yeah, two books out right now, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and the National Geographic Almanac 2019. Also, don't forget that I have a ton of really cool new swag in the Talk Nerdy store, and I would love for you to check it out. You can support the podcast and also look cool doing it. Lots of people have been checking it out, have been ordering new cool stuff. I've got like beanies because it's getting cold outside, hoodies and pullover sweatshirts and the same old stuff, you know, t-shirts and other good stuff. So check it out. That's at talknerdymerch.com. Sorry, one more time. That's talknerdymerch.com. Oh my gosh. I'm so tired. I always thank the patrons that are sponsoring each episode. Remember, if you want to sponsor the episode or each episode of Talk Nerdy, you can go to patreon.com/talknerdy and look at what is involved in that. You can pledge literally 50 cents an episode, and it's hugely, hugely helpful. Remember, I really heavily rely on support from listeners just like you because Talk Nerdy is and will always be free to download. So I'm never going to charge anybody to listen to it. The top patrons this week include Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but not least, Jeffrey Sewell. Oh my gosh. And also, I forgot to mention, maybe you guys know this if you've been following on social media, but I was in the UK a couple of weeks ago having so much fun in Manchester, in Edinburgh, in London, at Cambridge. So many really cool listeners came up and were super warm and just so nice telling me about your experiences listening to the show, giving your feedback and your recommendations. And it really did warm my heart. It was the best birthday. I turned 35 while we were doing the Cambridge show, and the entire audience sang to me and gave me a cake with the Talk Nerdy logo on top. It meant so much to me. We were there promoting the Skeptic's Guide book. But you guys showed me your love for this little podcast, and it made me super happy. Okay, I have a really good one for you guys this week, and I apologize that it's kind of been sitting in the can for a while because of scheduling issues. So if anything in it is not 100% timely, I apologize in advance. But I think it all is because the topic is fascinating. Okay, I had a chance to sit down with Dr. Tammy Ben Yedidia, and she is the chief scientific officer of Beyond Vax Pharmaceuticals. Her job there is, you know, she's the head of science there, and she's leading the efforts developing the first, get this, multi-season, multi-strain, quote-unquote, universal flu vaccine. She got her doctorate in an immunology lab at the Weizmann Institute of Science, where she worked in designing these peptide-based vaccines against multiple pathogens, and one of those pathogens was influenza, so she was kind of involved in the earliest research on this. She's widely published in immunology and the flu, and they're pretty far along with their human trials in this incredible new technology. So we're going to tell you all about it. I got to chat with her all the way from Israel. So without further ado, here she is, Dr. Tammy Ben-Yedidia. Well, Tammy, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure. I'm happy to talk to you today because 2018 is 100 years from the fatal pandemic of the Spanish flu, which occurred in 1918. So influenza in the beginning of the winter is indeed an interesting issue to discuss.
Absolutely. And so we're actually connecting from very far away. You're in Israel right now, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Where in Israel are you?
We are in Jerusalem. We have a new facility in Jerusalem near the Hadassah Hospital. It's a biotechnology company, a very exciting one with all kind of new startups and some that are not at the very beginning, like we are, that we're in advanced clinical trials. But it's a very good environment to come to work, the beautiful view, and everybody is enthusiastic about what we do.
Lovely. It's late at night here in Los Angeles, but it's first thing, not even, it's in the morning in Israel, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Technology, it's a wonderful thing. So you mentioned that you're working on a universal flu vaccine. Before we dive into the specific work that you're doing, I would love to hear about your education, how you got into this kind of work. Are you an immunologist?
I am an immunologist. When I was in high school, I learned a lot of biology and I loved it a lot. So I continued to do this in the university. And eventually, I worked in a company that developed a vaccine for hepatitis B. And I was in the R&D. It was very exciting. And we did a lot of things and found that the vaccine was very effective. And then when it moved to the next stage of marketing and the production for the market, I felt that it's really boring because you have to do exactly the same thing every day. I have to leave the R&D and move to the manufacturing department. And then I said, okay, I have enough of this. I want to do something different and something new, but still keep my knowledge of immunology and expand it. So I went to the Weizmann Institute of Science, which is one of the best institutions in Israel and I think also in the world. And I studied immunology at the lab of Professor Ruth Arnon. She is the inventor of the Copaxone drug, a drug that was developed in our lab. And then it is already in the market. I think the patent already expired some months ago. But we had a feeling of doing something very important. And Okay, we had this drug for the multiple sclerosis, and we said the other branch of the lab was focusing on the influenza. And we felt that there is a significant need for a better vaccine because influenza vaccines are the only vaccine that should be given every year. And it doesn't really make sense because other vaccines, you give them to a newborn or once in several years, and that's enough. Like tetanus, that you get it once in 5 or once in 7 years, and it holds for a long time. So why cannot we find something similar for the flu?
Exactly. Like I think my yellow fever vaccine, for example, is a lifetime vaccine. I never have to get it again.
Exactly. So our immune system is something very sophisticated. We know a lot about it, so we have to teach it properly how to recognize the influenza viruses, although it is changing. And by that, to get a universal vaccine, one that will be for a multi-season or at least several seasons for every strain of flu or at least for many strains of flu, not one that you should get every year because the thing that you have to get a vaccine every year, and there are a lot of doubts about the efficacy of this vaccine, makes people to avoid it. I mean, most of my friends don't take vaccine. I don't take the flu vaccine because why should I bother?
Because some years it's much stronger than other years, or some years I should say it's more effective than other years.
Oh, you don't have to convince me, but I think that if there is a better vaccine or a vaccine that people will trust it, then they will go and get vaccinated.
And so what are the reasons that certain vaccines, like a yellow fever vaccine, for example, only have to be taken once, but the current version of the influenza vaccine must be taken every single year?
Actually, most of the vaccines should be taken once. All the mumps, the measles, all these vaccines, you only take them once when you are a child, and that's it. You are protected for your whole life because these viruses are conservative. They don't change. They look exactly the same from year to year and year after year. So when you teach the immune system once that this is the virus, when you see it, you have to attack it and to kill it and prevent the disease, then the immune system is willing or knows how to do it. With influenza viruses, it is more complicated because the virus is changing, and every year it looks different from the envelope of the virus. The way it looks from the outside is different. Like I'm telling you, when you see a red virus, kill it. And then the next year it comes and it is green. So you don't really recognize it because you're looking for something red.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we had in our PhD, in my PhD at the Weizmann Institute, is to find the common denominator for all influenza viruses. It's like I'm telling you, okay, there is a red virus, a green virus, a yellow virus. They are all influenza because they have, I don't know, a brown tip on their left side. And then you look for this small little tip that is similar in all of them. And then you say, okay, so I have this tip, this is influenza, I'm going to kill it. So that's what we do. We found the common denominator, something that is comparatively small, but it allows the immune system to identify the different viruses as influenza. Is it clear?
Absolutely. My question is, do epidemiologists or immunologists or virologists, do we have a good understanding through these disciplines as to why influenza is so variable every year, as opposed to these other viruses that can infect people that, as you said, are more conservative, that don't change?
It's not only influenza. There are other viruses that are also changing. For example, the HIV, the AIDS virus, and the many viruses that their nucleic acids are RNA and not DNA, are less stable, and they introduce many mutations because of being unstable, and then the whole virus, or at least the envelope of the virus, is changing.
So the RNA within the flu virus is mutating, and it's mutating so much that the next winter, my flu virus from last winter won't work on it anymore. Or my flu vaccine, I'm sorry, from last winter will no longer work on this newly mutated flu.
That's exactly what happens. And since there are so many mutations and the virus is changing every year, we have to find a solution for that. And one optional solution is to include multiple viruses within the vaccine, because this is what was usually done since the 19th century, when vaccines were invented by Louis Pasteur and Edward Jenner, that they took the pathogen, they killed it or attenuated it, and used it for vaccination to teach the immune system how the virus looks and to attack it. With influenza, it is not effective because killing the virus is leaving the envelope, which is changing, exposed to the immune system, and then it recognizes something that is not relevant for the next season and will not be effective. So one way is to teach it how to recognize all kinds of viruses, but then there are so many that it is really hard to do. Still, some companies or some academic labs are trying to do this thing. Others are focusing on the recognizing or identifying the regions that do not change so much and use them to teach the immune system. And that's what we do.
I have a question about the effectiveness of current flu vaccines. Is it true that if you get a flu vaccine every single year, the effectiveness is somewhat additive?
The effectiveness is highly variable because the current flu vaccines contain three or now four different envelopes of influenza viruses. And the main question is, when the WHO decides about these three or four viruses, is he making a correct guess? It is an educated guess because they try to see which viruses infected in the southern side, in the other side of the world, let's say in China or so, and they include these viruses. If they are correct and they include the viruses that actually circulate in the population, then we have a good vaccine and it reaches about 60% of effectiveness. On the other hand, if they are missing something, as it happened the last season, then the vaccine is not effective because they included in the vaccine a specific strain, which was not the one that was circulating. And the vaccine effectiveness can drop up to 10%, 20%, which is really not so helpful. And especially among elderly and young children, that they are the at-risk populations for such disease, the percentages drop sharply. We are following the vaccine effectiveness. I mean, not we at the company, but the CDC is doing that. And they publish figures saying that the flu vaccine effectiveness, let's say during the last 15 years, ranged between 10% to 60%.
Oh, wow. That's quite variable.
Highly variable, right?
And because the flu is constantly mutating, if I were to get a vaccine, let's say, 10 years ago, would it spontaneously be effective against a random flu coming next year? Would that ever happen?
Generally not, because virus is changing all the time. And in most cases, it doesn't go back to a virus that, I mean, it's not the same virus that you got it 10 years ago that will come again sometime in the future. Mm-hmm. It is constantly changing and the changes are unpredictable. On the other hand, in 2009, when we had the swine flu pandemic, it was a weird situation that elderly people that were exposed when they were children to a virus of H1N1, this is the same virus that was at the beginning of the previous century, they were better protected than young children that were not exposed to that virus. But this was one case. Another thing that you can say is that actually many people that have a good immune system, let's say from the age of 18 to 50 years old, they don't get flu every year. And they don't get it even though they are exposed to the virus. For example, if my children have the flu, not necessarily I will get it as well because my system works well and it will fight it. The risk is that young children and elderly people are getting exposed to these viruses, and then it's the slippery slope. They start coughing, they get a throat ache, they have all the influenza symptoms, and since their immune system is weak, they cannot fight it, and in many cases, they also get a secondary infection by a bacteria, and then it goes to pneumonia, and they get hospitalized, they catch another virus, and eventually the numbers are really frightening. There are up to 1.5 billion cases of flu worldwide. Out of them, 3 to 5 million are severe illnesses and 650,000 of deaths. This is worldwide. In the U.S., up to 56,000 deaths every year and 700,000 hospitalizations.
It's a very large number.
Very large number, yeah.
And you see a phenomenon here in the U.S., but probably, you know, to some extent globally, but it may be a uniquely American phenomenon, where there are individuals who deny the need for vaccines and who will even deny the detriment that influenza can bring because they live in a society with very good treatment options. They live in a society where if you get the flu, you have access to pain relievers and you have access to fluids for rehydration. And it's less likely in the United States that if you get the flu, you'll die. But I think it's important to remember that globally, this is a massive crisis.
Thank you for bringing it up. It's such an important issue, and it's not only in the US. I think it's in all the Western world that people forgot about the disease and they focus on the issues related to vaccination, which are so minor and so less significant than the disease itself. And we see that communities that do not get vaccinated, suddenly we see diseases we thought that are not with us anymore, like mumps. I think mumps is the most significant illness that suddenly started. And there is the phenomenon of herd immunity, which means that if 70% of the population is vaccinated and protected, it will also protect the 30% that are not vaccinated. Because let's say that I am vaccinated and if I am exposed to a virus, I will not get the disease and I will not infect someone else near me that is not vaccinated. But if I am not vaccinated and I will catch the disease, I will sneeze, I will spread it, and people near me that are not protected because, let's say, they have cancer or they have some immune deficiency and their immune system is not operating properly, then they will get a disease and they will get it in a higher extent. It can cause them a significant damage. I was just hearing on the news here in Israel that a child that went to a kindergarten, he was just recovering from cancer and he was not allowed to get vaccinated. And he got mumps from another child in the kindergarten that his parents decided not to vaccinate it because of some new age ideas. Mm-hmm. And healthy child that was not vaccinated recovered. And the one that just recovered from cancer got the disease and was hospitalized again. He was in a very bad situation at the time of that interview. Well, I don't know what happened eventually. I hope he recovered as well, but it's really being irresponsible not to get vaccinated. It's one of the most amazing achievements of medicine in the 20th century and these days as well.
Absolutely. And I also think that, you know, there are so many reasons in the Western world that we see this anti-vaccine rhetoric, whether it be denial of science or basically the outcome of progress. You know, if you're a young mother and you've never seen the horrors of polio, you may not remember why vaccination is so important. But beyond that, I think that a lot of people don't remember how bad the flu is. Somebody will get a bad cold and they'll think it's the flu. But when you have the flu, you are very sick, aren't you?
Yeah, people, it's really hard to say when it is flu. And people that are just getting some cold think that it's flu and it's not. When you have flu, you are 7 days in bed, your muscles ache, you don't move. You really feel that you are going to die out of it.
Uh-huh.
You have that hydration, you have sneezing, coughing, high fever, the whole body aches, runny noses, you're very tired. And why suffer if you can get a vaccine and avoid it? I mean, if there is a good vaccine, I would take it.
Absolutely. And that's really what you are dedicating all of your time to developing, is a so-called universal flu vaccine. Can you tell me a little bit about how you are attempting to achieve this?
Yes, I am glad to talk about it because I think it's really a great idea with a very good potential. As I explained at the beginning of our discussion, our idea was to find the common denominator for a seasonal and pandemic strain. So we were fortunate to have a lot of knowledge about the influenza virus and the its protein and how it is built and how it is acting by infecting the human cells. And I think it is the NIH, they have an amazing database of all the sequences of all influenza viruses since 1940 till today. Actually, every virus, every new influenza virus that is identified is sent to sequencing, and we know exactly how it is made of. And then we took all these lists of sequences and recognized regions that are not changing throughout the years. And we found such 9 sequences from 3 influenza proteins. I will tell you about one of them from the hemagglutinin. This is one of the envelope proteins that is generally very variable. But still, this protein has an important role in invasion of the virus into the host cell. It is like kind of a flower that it opens, and then it is attached to the human cells, in the nose or in the upper respiratory tract, and it kind of opens the cell and allows the virus to get into it and start the infection.
So this is very important, hemagglutinin.
Yeah. So we found a small region within this hemagglutinin close to the entrance point. It's like a key and a lock. So we found a region near the key of this hemagglutinin, and we included it in our vaccine. So when we immunize with this vaccine, we know that the body produces I will have to go a little bit into immunology. We have in the immune system cellular immunology and humoral immunology, and our vaccine activates the cellular immunology because the virus spends most of the time within the human cell, so it makes sense to target the cellular immunology. And we try to block the virus by not allowing this hemagglutinin to get attached to the cell.
And how do you do that?
Okay, so we found 9 such regions. They are called peptides. They are small regions from the proteins of the virus. We combine them into a single protein, which is our vaccine. When we immunize with this vaccine, we see that we can actually activate both arms of the immune system. Initially, we activate the cellular immunology, which are T cells. These are the white blood cells that produce antiviral substances like interferon gamma and the other, it's called cytokines. And these cytokines have a significant effect on the body and help him to fight the virus. On the other hand, when we give our vaccine, we also see elevation of the antibody response, the humoral immunity. And T cell immunity is actually priming the effect and enhances the antibody response. We see, for example, that if we immunize with our vaccine, and then we immunize with a regular flu vaccine, the one that is currently on the market, we see enhanced and broadened immunity in terms of antibody that can block the viral infection. Now, this is the mechanism of action. It is unique because the current vaccines only focus on the antibodies. And we believe that if you want to have a significant antibody response, you have to start from the beginning. Now that we know how the immune system works, we have to first activate the cellular immunity, and then we will also have a better humoral immunity, better antibody to the different viruses.
All right, everybody, I want to take a quick break to thank 2 new sponsors of the podcast this week, starting with Adagio. And I know you're going to love it, especially if you're a classical music fan like me. And I mean, like, really, really into classical music. And that's because when I use traditional streaming services to listen to classical music, I always have a really hard time, like, finding the exact recording that I'm looking for. You know, I may be able to find something by a specific composer, but I don't have any control over the concert artists involved or the orchestras or maybe the opera companies. And also sometimes I find that the recordings, like the quality of streaming service recordings for classical, isn't where I want it to be. But Adagio has fixed all of those problems for hardcore classical music fans like myself. They offer the best search designed for classical music with high quality streams and exclusive content. Like, for example, if you want to listen to Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, we all know it, we all love it. Adagio lets you compare more than 150 recordings all on one page and filter them by conductor or orchestra. You're never going to have a hard time finding just the right recording that you want. There are really cool playlists that are curated in case if you want to discover or know more about it, like Composer's Essentials playlists, which have Vivaldi, Chopin, Debussy, or the 10 most famous symphonies of all time, or Slow Piano, the Art of the Slow Piano Movement. Or my favorite is that you can pick playlists to suit your mood. Like there's a stay focused playlist or a pure relaxation playlist or even sleep playlists. So guys, you should try Adagio for free for 14 days, and then you only pay $9.99 a month when you subscribe. So to try it out, visit podcast.adagio.com/nerdy. For this really great deal, 14 days free, you've just got to go to podcast.adagio. Let's spell that for you. It's IDAGIO.com/nerdy. One more time, it's podcast.adagio.com/nerdy. I also want to thank HelloFresh for their support of Talk Nerdy. And I got to be honest, guys, I tried HelloFresh. I have no idea why I waited so long. So good. I'm not sure which meal was my favorite because I tried their fajita bar, I tried their chicken sausage orzato, and also their Korean beef bibimbap. That might have been my favorite. It was so good. So good. HelloFresh, in case you didn't know, is a meal delivery kit, and they do everything for you. They shop for you, they plan the meal for you, and they deliver step-by-step recipes, pre-measured ingredients, so that you don't really have to do any work at all except throw them together and eat them with your family. So good. And they also have 3 meal plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family, which is really good. So when I say family, I mean you yourself too. You can be your own family, just like me. I look forward to my HelloFresh delivery, knowing that my dinner just got that much easier and I don't have to order in. I actually get to cook and feel really proud of myself, even though I'm not a good cook. HelloFresh makes it super easy. And they've got this global eats option, which has authentic international dishes to bring, you know, new options of things that maybe I wouldn't feel very confident cooking on my own. They make it super, super easy. All of the ingredients, like I said, come pre-measured in these handy labeled meal kits. I know exactly which ingredients go with which recipe, and it's so easy not to screw up. My favorite is that everything's delivered to your door in recyclable, insulated packaging. And of course, there are a lot of one pot recipes, which is so easy. Minimal cleanup, best part. So yeah, guys, you can spend less time planning your meals and grocery shopping every week. You can get back to doing more of what you love, doing more of the work you care about, spending more time with your friends and families. And of course, these are less than $10 per serving with free shipping. So guys, for a total of $60 off, that's $20 off your first 3 boxes, all you've got to do is go to HelloFresh.com/TalkNerdy60 and enter the promo code TalkNerdy60. That's TalkNerdy and then the number 60. Again, $60 off, $20 off your first 3 offers. That's HelloFresh.com/TalkNerdy60. It's like receiving 6 meals for free. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So when you say that you see this increased response or this increased effectiveness compared to the flu vaccines, the annual flu vaccines that we currently use, what stage of testing are you in with your universal vaccine? Are you giving it to cells in a petri dish? Have you given it to different animals? Are you already testing it on humans?
Now, we are now in a very exciting stage of this development. Of course, that initially we tested it in preclinical models in mice, but We know that mice are not human, and you cannot say that if something works well in mice, it will be also effective in humans. And actually, the FDA forces us to go into clinical trials, not only us, but any new vaccine, any new drug must be tested in clinical trials. And our first trial was in 2008, and since then we had 7 successful clinical trials. And in these clinical trials, we had 700 participants, and we saw, first of all, that the vaccine is safe. It does not induce any adverse events that can pose a risk to the people that get it. And we tested it in adults, in younger adults, in older adults, also in elderly. And it is always the first and most important endpoint to show the safety of the vaccine. Once showing the safety, we can go a step forward and look for the immunogenicity. And indeed, in these trials, we found that people that get our vaccine have elevated cellular immunology or cellular immunity and also humoral immunity. We came with all this data to the EMA, which is similar to the American FDA, but in Europe, and we proposed them our ideas about getting to the next step. And they accepted our trial design to look finally for the efficacy of the vaccine, because this is the final proof that it is really effective. You don't really know if somebody is having, I have 100 units of interferon gamma. Is it good? Is it sufficient? Will it protect me from getting the disease? It's a question that I don't have an answer to it, because for somebody that is maybe over 85 years old, it will not be sufficient. For somebody that is 60, it might be enough. So the only way to show if a vaccine is effective is to immunize a large number of participants. In our trial, we're going to have 9,630 participants, and to follow them along the flu season to see if they have flu or not. Now, in our trial, we have divided the participants into two arms. One arm is getting placebo, saline, that actually they're not expected to be vaccinated. And the other half is getting our vaccine twice. They get a vaccine, they actually get it during August and September right now in Europe. Mm-hmm. And then everyone goes home and continues with their lives. But if they feel that they have something that looks like flu, if they are sneezing, if they have throat ache, if they have fever, they must report it to the clinical site. And then we send a nurse to collect swab sample from their nose and throat. And in this swab sample, we are going to look for influenza virus. If we see influenza virus, we know that it is indeed influenza infection, not some other virus, not some other bacterial infection. And we're going to count how many cases of flu, confirmed cases of flu, we have in the experimental group and in the control group. And we expect to see that the higher numbers are observed in the control group as compared to the experimental group. And this will show that the vaccine is indeed effective. We're going to have two exciting years until we know the results. By now, we are blinded. We don't know if any of the participants, each participant is getting a placebo or it is getting our vaccine. And we look forward to the next flu season to see the numbers.
Very exciting. So, as you said, this is a double-blind study. Neither the participants nor the investigators know who received the vaccine and who received the placebo.
Exactly. Nobody knows. Only the statistician will know eventually. And they do the calculation and they will tell us the outcomes of this trial.
So really, this is the time when the fruits of your labor are bearing out. You've been working in the laboratory for years towards this human trial, and within the next year or two, you're going to start to see the results.
Yes, it is a very exciting time for us. We have to wait patiently. We'll know by the end of 2020, maybe 2021, exactly what is going on.
And in the meantime, my assumption, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the vaccine is being delivered by clinicians and it's going to take time to collect that data. So in the meantime, what are you doing in the lab? Are you working on a new project? Are you continuing to improve this vaccine?
Okay, what a question. First of all, running a trial of that 10,000, almost 10,000 participants is a lot of effort, and we all focus on this thing. As I said in the beginning, we are now located in Jerusalem, which is a new facility. So we are preparing ourselves for a successful outcome of the trial, and we want to be ready that if everything goes well, we will be ready to produce the vaccine for the market. So we moved into this new facility. We're going to have all the equipment to produce the vaccine in our place. The vaccine that is currently used in the trial in Europe was produced by an American company that we just hired for this purpose, a CMO. But we want to have it in our hands and keep the knowledge in the company. And it may sound very simple, just buy the equipment and start producing it, as you did for the previous smaller trials. It is a significant task. We have to implement all the upscaling knowledge. For example, when we produce the vaccine in our old facility, we use a fermenter of 20 liters, and we didn't even fill it up to the end. We used a volume of 10 liters, and now we're going to produce the same thing in a 200 liters fermenter. So if I will take it to the kitchen, it's really different. If you want to make a cup of coffee or 1,000 cups of coffee, you have to make sure that it is well mixed. All of the cups are identical. It will take us some time to get ready and to produce it in a larger scale.
So not only is BeyondVax doing the research and development, but you also have plans to produce the vaccine at scale.
Yes, it is a significant challenge to move from a small scale to a larger scale. And we have the people that have the knowledge, and we have 2 years till the end of the trial to finalize this process of upscaling and produce it under GMP conditions. It is a good manufacturing process that everything should be done exactly the same, so that each batch of the vaccine is comparable to previous batches.
It must be quite exciting for you from a personal perspective to be so close with something you've been working on for the better part of your career.
Carrie, no, I'm talking and I'm smiling because I really feel so excited about this, because when I had my PhD, I didn't imagine that I'm going to conduct a trial with almost 10,000 participants getting the vaccine that I had in my mind, and that finally we're going to know if all these efforts and all these years of research are paid, if it really works. We have good indication because we know it is immunogenic, we know it is safe, but now it's the moment of truth. We will know if it works, and all our wishes and all our plans work well.
So exciting. And of course, you are the chief scientific officer of BeyondVax. So the work that you do there, you oversee the science there at the company, it is primarily focused on this one vaccine, isn't it?
Yes.
I wonder how many people realize, maybe how many people who are listening to this podcast right now were aware of just how long it takes for a new medication, especially a whole new class of medication, like a universal flu vaccine, to come to pass, from the earliest experiments up through it being marketed and people being able to take the drug. We're talking decades.
It is indeed a very long process. You know that when we started working, there were many other companies that also looked for the common denominator for influenza virus and wanted to have a universal vaccine in a similar approach like ours. And then in 2009, there was the swine flu pandemic that was spreading very fast around the world, but we were lucky that it was not very aggressive. And then in that virus of the swine flu, there were several mutations in a protein that was thought to be a conserved one. And it was five or six companies that just closed after the swine pandemic because they found that their guess about the, or their thought about the vaccine that they developed were wrong because it was not really conserved. And in the swine flu virus, this region was changing. We were lucky enough to include this region in our vaccine, so we kept working and kept conducting clinical trials. But it is surprising us. We never know which virus will come next. Our strategy to avoid this case that we'll have a virus that with different peptides is to include the nine different peptides in our vaccine. So the chances that all nine of them will suddenly mutate and will not be relevant anymore is really very low. At least we know that for the last 15 years that the company is active, we see that every virus that appears still contain these sequences of peptides.
It's very smart, and in a way, it reminds me a bit of some of the more recent research that biotechnologists are doing with transgenic organisms, because there's often a risk that a pest, if you're developing an organism to make its own pesticide, that a pest will become resistant to it. So it seems like newer generation GM crops might have 2, 3, or 4 different transgenes within it to improve pest resistance, in the hopes that even if we become resistant to one, that the chances become astronomical that, as you said, all nine peptides would be mutated.
I think this is the nice thing in science, that you always expect surprises. You never know what's going to happen, and nature is stronger than us, and we try with our knowledge to expand it, to know more, and to improve the health of the population.
Oh, absolutely. And on that note, Tammy, I would love to close our conversation by asking you the same two questions that I ask every guest I have on the show. Would you be all right with that?
Sure.
All right. So they're kind of big picture questions. The first one is, when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you personally, so it could be your own future, the future of your work, the future of the planet, you know, any context. Number one, what is the thing that most worries you? What keeps you up the most at night? And number two, so that we end on a more positive note, what is the thing, when you think about the future, that is the most optimistic, that you look forward to the most?
Well.
Big ones, huh? Big questions.
What keeps me awake at night is something that you mentioned previously in our talk. These people, these new age people that decide not to vaccinate their children, and they are not aware of the damage that they cause and the sorrow that they cause to other people in their community. I would really like to see people looking into the science, reading carefully, not just listening to some internet talk and decide that they are not going to take care of their children and get them vaccinated. We have to trust science. I mean, FDA especially, so strict. They are so clear about their demands from a vaccine that it should be safe. We have to, even if we show that our vaccine works in this clinical trial, we will have to follow it for 5 years and to show that it keeps being effective. Because FDA doesn't want us to provide to the population something that worked 1 year and then it's not effective anymore. So we have to put a lot of efforts in being good for many years, not just showing once that something works and then go home and be happy with it. I mean, the people in the US and all over should appreciate all these efforts of the scientists, of the regulators, to do something good in the world. Now, being optimistic, that's easy. There are so many other things that should be developed. If there was a good vaccine for nicotine that would prevent people from getting lung cancer, this would be amazing. And I think it is possible because we know what causes the disease. And if we teach the immune system how to fight it properly, then people will not be smoking anymore. If we can have a vaccine for neurodegenerative diseases, it would be amazing because people now have a long lifespan, but then when they are getting old, sometimes, or no, not sometimes, in many cases, they get the Alzheimer or Parkinson or all these diseases that we know that the immune system is involved in them. So I hope that we will get to an invention that will use the immune system to fight these diseases and prevent them.
Hear, hear. Absolutely. I think, obviously, I agree wholeheartedly. I think many of the people listening to the podcast right now also agree wholeheartedly. And with a resounding thank you for the incredible work that you and your team are doing to help increase global health and to help prevent this devastating disease, I'm so, so grateful that you were able to take the time today to join us and to teach us a little bit more about the work that you're doing.
Kara, thank you very much for the opportunity to meet your audience and to present them with what we do. I hope that they will share our excitement.
Absolutely. And if they're interested to learn even more about your work, where should they go to learn more?
They can go to our website. It is www.beyondvax.com. There is a lot of material. There is even a cartoon explaining what we do and what is the principle. For people that have some biological background, they can go and read the scientific papers. We also have the links in the site. This will cover everything.
Excellent. Well, Tammy, thank you again so much for joining me. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.